That's Monty Alexander with The Heathen. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It's Wednesday, October the 10th, the eve of another debate, this one between the vice presidential candidates. But do you know, I hate to tell you, but I'm just not excited about this at all. This election, I know there's so much resting on it. And I mean, so much money has been raised by the candidates, all the spending hitting record levels. People are pushed to the edge and yet are pushed even further because as distressed as we are, we're still encouraged to take responsibility. This is our country. This is our democracy. We are to assume our rights and exercise our rights as citizens to protect and maintain democracy. Even though people say, well, the democracy hasn't protected and maintained us, but still, the pressure, the move is on. And I talked about this yesterday, the idea that there's going to be intense psychological pressure to get us to wrap our brains around something. And that is, as intense as things are, as stark as the choices are, as improbable as it is that we actually can, and we are actually participating in a democratic exercise, we are nonetheless going to be saddled psychologically with the burden of being responsible for the outcome. And in this moment, and I want us to take a look at this, this is very serious about how things are done by the state. I mean, the apparatus of government and the apparatus of media and the apparatus of the civil and civic organizations all come together, and we get a concoction of a kind of unreality. It is not really about what is happening at ground level. It would be made to look like it is about what is happening at ground level, but it really isn't. Because the process of election is so different from the process of selection. What do I mean? At the local and statewide and national levels, for the most part, people have absolutely nothing to do. They are not invited to participate in the process of selection of a candidate. This is outside of our purview. This is something we're supposed to have nothing to do with. All you are required to do in this equation of democracy is just show up and fall either for candidate A or candidate B, the pre-selected, predetermined candidates. The conventions are held, lots of noise, which is a big sales. It's a big sales pitch. The debates are yet other sales pitches. But we are not engaged in the literal meaning of this word democracy. We don't have that involvement, and we are not expected to have that involvement. And we need to start making the distinction between the process of election and the process of selection. It becomes meaningful, this notion of democracy, when we are involved in the process of selection. We choose the candidate, and the candidate, in return, recognizes that there is a connection, an organic link between the people and him or herself. There is a kind of commonality of purpose. There is an identification immediately with what the issues and demands are of the constituency or constituencies that are supporting the candidate. And then we get involved in things like, what is going to be the philosophy? What is going to inform our polity? What is going to involve, to be involved in the way we look at things, and therefore how do we shape policies? How do we shape priorities based on that model? That is not going to happen. What is going to happen until somebody decides to have it done as a kind of a movement, a resurgence of a movement? There are times in the political landscape where attempts, very good attempts, have been made at this, which is a larger mass involvement. But the American society has little appetite or tolerance for something like this. This very thing, the actual ground-up involvement in politics, is itself seen as undemocratic and undesirable. It is an evil thing. It's the kind of thing the communists talk about, and the socialists, and the way left of center people. Those are the ones. They want that kind. That's the kind of stuff that happens in China and Russia and all these places there. You have totalitarian governments. But actually, that's what democracy really is. The actual involvement at the ground level, and it is not the personality that reigns supreme or that rules, it is the priorities. It's what needs to be done. Here in the Hollywood version, we get to decide on the candidate based on whether the teeth are straight, whether they look like Johnny Depp, or we get to make our decisions based on a whole bunch of things that one major institution in the United States literally shaped, which is Hollywood. Hollywood dictates our appetites. Hollywood dictates our priorities. Hollywood controls the sale. And so, in that atmosphere, we could hardly expect that we would have an intelligent, involved electorate. What we would have in the formula that is at work, what we have to have, what is absolutely necessary, is a brain-dead electorate who can't understand that all these huge productions are about the illusion of democracy, the illusion of participation. It's the Wizard of Oz. We show up, but there is somebody behind that curtain manipulating things, giving us our reality, telling us what we should think is important, whether it is important or not in our lives. If we say that this is important, they tell us no, that is important. And you'd find incredible agreement, unanimity of agreement on some of the things you say, but why are these people agreeing on these things? Why are they? Because they have vested interests and they have a common cause. And their common cause is to take this entire process, to hijack a process, make it look like a popular process, but it really is a process involving a very tiny group of people. And I say tiny with respect to the relationship, the proportion. A very small group of people are in charge. They may differ about a whole bunch of things, but they agree that they are in charge. They recognize that. They have that in common. So in an election year, when you're looking for glimpses of recognition by the parties, that politics ought to have evolved to something different by now, based on the realities, based on the crushing realities that the people are suffering, and it doesn't matter where. In which case, the United States is typical of any other country going through a catharsis. Whether the country is described as socialist or communist or liberal or what conservative or whatever, there is a line of demarcation that has been drawn, and it is the same story. It is the same line that people are becoming very much aware that the apparatus of government is not only not serving them well or at all, but it is out of control. It is out of their control. If the definition of democracy is that it is governed by the people and for the people, then all of the problems that we recognize as humongous, as detrimental, as extremely critical, are the problems that are of the making of a small group of people who are doing whatever they wish to do. They're not asking our permission. They're not asking whether we should spend trillions of dollars on a war machine. They're not asking us permission to bail out anybody. They're not asking us what we think about taxes. This is where Obama and Romney are perfectly in accord. They agree. They have a little difference, and the difference is who should really pull the strings of the purse. Who controls the strings of the purse? Should it be the Democrats or the Republicans? But they both agree it certainly should not be us. This is what we ought to see. This is where our government is and has been for a long time. And it is irrelevant increasingly whether it is the Democrats who are doing it or the Republicans are doing it. The fact is, we have not had movement in Congress for 3 years. We don't have a budget for 3 years. And these are the brightest minds, allegedly, that we have spawned as a nation. They have all the knowledge. They have all that they need to make wise decisions or just make a decision. They have not made a decision for 3 years. And certainly, I mean, that's the lowest of expectations that the electorate has, is that we should have a government that should make a decision. Make a decision. That's what you're there for. They're not asking anybody anything. And government has become, well, look, I was smart to be elected. That means I'm smarter than you. I have the ability to make more money than you. Imagine. Barack Obama's campaign this year would have raised $1 billion, with a B, $1 billion alone. And there's a lot of thinking that comes along with that. The notion of superiority, the notion, in fact, of what they accuse people of, the notion of entitlement. If I am smart enough to do these kinds of things, if I'm capable enough to do these kinds of things, surely it must be that I am smarter, infinitely smarter than you. I don't have to listen to you. I do not have to do what you tell me to do. You should trust that this is evidence of my capability, my capacity for leadership. And the inference is so direct. If this is my leadership, then it is also, hello, this is what is coming. It is also an indication of what you ought to do as a follower. You are not a decision maker. There is no parity here. Don't come to us talking about your rights as a citizen. I've said here before, nobody has any rights that are absolute. And by the way, that applies to your voting rights. You do not have a constitutional guarantee, a constitutional right to vote. It is not your right. Nobody knows what it is. It is not a right. It is not a privilege. It is not defined, period, in the Constitution. But we are being told it is a right. And further, it is a responsibility. This is our part in the charade. And so the money is spent to energize our delusions. We are supposed to separate ourselves and our concrete realities. What we know is happening, which is what politics is. Politics is what's happening to you in your life. That's politics. You don't need any major sophisticated definition of that. That's politics. But they're telling us it's something else. And it really isn't. And they're all doing it. They're all doing it. So I think I've hit the wall with respect to the lack of excitement about the political process. In fact, it has developed a certain distaste for me. I just don't want to connect with it anymore because I see it for what it is. And this has nothing to do with any personal feelings about what I, you know, whether I like Obama. It's not about that at all, because I'm very, very dispassionate and clinical about politics. And as I said here yesterday, which is where I was going with this, in this scenario, you would think that the alternatives, the people who are in opposition, would have a far more insightful way of operating. And there too is huge disappointment. It's as if they don't get it. It's as if they can't understand what they need to do. It does not help to simply construct a parallel to what is repugnant. Parallelism is not the order of the day. It's not going to get us anywhere. Alternatives, true, workable alternatives, realizable, achievable alternatives. You don't get realizable, workable, provable alternatives by simply constructing a parallel structure. So the Republicans have a convention and the Democrats have a convention. Hey, we have a convention too. That's not what's going to get it. What has to be done is very, very unattractive, unsexy work. And it is going to be brutally long, hard work. When you are engaged in constructing alternatives, it automatically means that you have to come up with something so innovative, so different. So if it looks like what you're fighting, then you're on the wrong track. There is a negative associated with repeating the same thing, the same approach, yielding the same result, which is repeated failure. And your own folks are going to get fed up with repeated failure. It becomes an anesthetic. If you are going to say to people, expect to lose, year after year, cycle after cycle, expect to lose, then you are useless. You have to have a system, and it is not important whether you jump into the fray with everybody else this time around. You can jump into the fray when you are ready. When you are ready, you jump into the fray. You don't have to do it now. It's not one of those things. You do it when you are ready. And when you are ready, it means you have a structure in place that can deliver some degree of success at something. You don't have to win in the conventional ways of winning. You define even that. You're in charge of that. You conceptualize it and you execute on that plan. It could be modest, I don't care. It is imperative, however, that it is successful. Because if you are planning to repeat an unsuccessful model, as the saying goes, include me out. I don't want to be part of failure. I don't want to be part of that. I like the idea of success. But even in the opposition, there's this notion that success is itself a bad thing. We don't want to succeed. That's what capitalists do. Well, okay. In which case, put me down as a capitalist. I like the idea of success. I like the idea that somebody should say, you know what? Here is what this is what we are targeting. We're going to win a seat in the city council. Actually, this year we're going to win 3 seats. That's the goal. Okay. Then I'm okay with that. So now all of your planning is about 3 seats. You become obsessed about your 3 seats and winning your 3 seats. You have a number of things contingent upon winning these 3 seats. You develop a structure to deliver success about your 3 seats. It is immaterial what anybody else thinks. It is a goal. This is what we are going to do. Why are we going to do it? Because A, B, C, and D. What does it take to get that done? Here's 1, 2, 3, and 4. Simple, articulated goal. And you pursue the goal, no matter how modest it is. And you make sure you succeed at the goal. But this is not happening, even in the opposition. And they expect people to invest in a losing proposition time and time and time again. And I don't understand why they can't get it. People want to invest in something that works. And it is the responsibility, it seems to me, of the opposition to deliver evidence. By now, it should be compelled to do that. in order to qualify for further support. What is your success model? What is your apparatus? What is your structure? What is the vehicle that you are driving, that you want us to jump on board and drive along with you? What is it? Suddenly we are supposed to also do like the mainstream. Don't worry, forget about it. Leave that to us. We just want you to sign on and ride along with us. And this way, we can all say we have journeyed, we've made this journey together. And isn't that what it's about? No, no, and no. I am interested in pooling whatever puny resources that I have with people who are interested in achieving success at something. I'm interested in constructing alternatives. I'm not interested in parallelism, because you know in geometry what parallel lines do. They never, ever intersect. You are simply going along on your own little frequency in your own delusional world that you are achieving something. And you're not. And we have to call that out. The left has to be called out, because they are engaging in the same delusions as the Republicans and the Democrats. Everybody's doing it. It is the most, pardon the pun, democratic thing. We can all engage in an exercise of futility. The urgency of the conditions under which we are living and the pressures and stresses that these things are causing require, this is not optional, they require an entirely different response. They require success models. And you have to be able by now, this far down the road, after so many attempts that should have said to people, hey folks, we are merely patterning ourselves against a model that does not work. We are recreating the beast, only giving it a new name. But there is very little evidence to suggest that we have a working model for success, a healthy alternative. And by that I mean, if you're going to be in politics and you're not interested in winning, then get out. If you're going to play in this milieu and you are going to put into play the same kinds of silly exercises that people have, that you're interested in how many people show up at a meeting, that's not going to get it. That's not going to get it. What I'm talking about is real grungy, unsexy, really tough, hard road, a road to hoe. This is what I'm talking about. And by now, we should have some kind of evidence from whichever party says it is an alternative party. We should have the evidence of their success model. And if it doesn't smell like success, then become a capitalist and reject it. We'll take your calls after this break. You're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Mutrice Lead, and I'm kind of on a little tirade here, talking about why, even from the progressive world and the left of center world, we're getting very disturbing messages. This willful resistance to success, political success, and we have to take a look at it because it's very disturbing, very disturbing. You can call and get in on the conversation at 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888, and we have Dave. You're on the air. Thank you, Dave, for joining us.
Hi, Eutrice.
Hello.
Hi. I enjoyed your tirade, but I just want a couple of clarifications. The first, in terms of voting and what our rights are in the Constitution, my understanding is that we have the right, quote-unquote, to vote for the House of Representatives, and since 1913, since I forget the number of the amendment, the Senate. But we do not have the constitutional right to vote for the president. So I wasn't sure what you meant when you said we don't even have a right to vote for period.
Go ahead. The constitutional guarantees with regard to voting, I mean, we have all these various amendments that speak to it in an indirect way, in a way. But there is no constitutional guarantee that you or I or any other citizen voting has a right to do that. And this is in fact at the crux of all of these issues voting rights violations. The seminal question really is, do we as citizens have a right to vote? And if so, what specifically in the Constitution guarantees that right? Because if we have a right to vote, then it ought to be articulated specifically in the Constitution. But it has been the case where this is concerned that that right, A, has been extremely uneven, and that right has been guaranteed, if I could use that word, not by the Constitution, by the U.S. Supreme Court. And, of course, the court, as we know, makes decisions from time to time that are just plain outrageous. In fact, one right was that, one decision was that we did not have the right. Many people did not have that right to vote. That's the Voting Rights Act of 1964, which became effective in 1965. So there are whole classes of people denied that alleged right. There's a question of, is it natural law or is it constitutional law? This is the argument, really, in the very, very democratic United States. Do we have, as citizens, a right to vote?
Well,
nobody seems to know.
Isn't in Article 1 of the Constitution, we're told we can vote for the House of for our representative, and then in the, I forget which number amendment, senators were now going to be elected by popular vote, at least in the federal government. Now, I know in Bush versus Gore of the Supreme Court, they said that there's no constitutional right to vote for president, so that's still the case. But what about Article 1 of the Constitution?
I'm still trying to tell you that even at the Article 1 stage, this right is not a right enjoyed by anybody. It is not a right. It is just not a right. It is what you may do. Citizens may vote. It is not a right. And it certainly is not an absolute right, because we have whole classes of people for a very long time. Women did not have that right. African Americans did not have that right. Native Americans did not have that right. It's still an issue. In this whole conversation about democracy and the shaping of democracy, as we will get into in this program, in this on Lead Stories, we're going to be doing a series of programs on this very question. Do you have a right to vote? And the answer is no. You may be permitted to vote, but you don't have a right to vote.
Okay, so the other clarification I wanted was, in talking about the alternatives, the alternative parties and what they need to do, and about the parallel lines that you mentioned. The alternative party I've been following the most is the Green Party, and they are what they're doing is pretty much parallel, as you say, to, you know, to the two corporate parties, but they are trying, it seems to me that they are trying to succeed. The Jill Stein campaign is making a very energetic effort to fundraise with the hope of, if they can get as high as 5% in the vote. I know it's a long shot, but she has been working very hard in the face of stiff media blackout against, to try and raise enough money to get into some media, which she has succeeded in doing, and ultimately in getting 5% of the vote, after which the Green Party would get $20 million, which would be able to make them penetrate, you know, and with the disgust that people are feeling, I mean, these sentiments that you're expressing are certainly not unique. So the entire country is pretty much, you know, very hip to just how corrupted the two corporate parties are.
Well, so, you realize you just said something that is itself a kind of conundrum for the Green Party. If the Green Party were an alternative, the last thing it should be concerned about is whether it gets matching funds. Look, this has nothing to do with indicting the Green Party or any specific party. I'm sure, in fact, I would absolutely state that I believe strongly that Ms. Stein has a genuine concern about the people, a genuine concern about alternatives. I'm saying I'm looking at the manifestation of the party. And at this stage, let's get fundamental about this. At this stage, I mean, somebody ought to be able to advise a party that if it is interested in success, you cannot raise funds, you cannot conduct a campaign, you cannot excite an electorate, you cannot do all of these things at the same time and win. This is not about how hard anybody's working. This is about how smart are you working? If you're serious about a candidacy, you plan for it. That's what got Barack Obama in office. There was nothing really in his favor at the time that he wanted to go. I mean, from the political sense, here's a guy, he was still wet behind the ears. He, you know, he just got into Senate, and nobody looking at this guy said, you know, what a gall this guy has. You just got into the Senate and now you want to be president. You come out of Chicago and, you know, basically nobody knows you. You're not a household name. You have nothing going for you. And you're black on top of all. You could pile all of the negatives. But what he did is he constructed his system. And it was not dependent on whether people liked him or not. It was not about whether people understood his message or not. All these things helped. But it was a system that, independent of anything else, was able to deliver a very desired result. That's what I'm talking about. So I am not impressed what in 2012, when somebody tells me that the head of any political party hoping to have any kind of significance in the political arena as a representative of a constituency is working hard. Well, geez, you're supposed to do that. What I want to understand by working hard is that I want to see a track record of you building and working to build your system so that by the time you announce yourself, it has nothing that says you have to be in the race this year. Maybe the magic number is 2016. But by 2016, when you get up on a podium and you say, this is what we're going to do, we're going to capture A, B, and C, that it is very, very likely that it will be a done deal because you have constructed your system. Don't tell me now, you're running and you got to, how hard it is to raise funds. Listen, this is politics. Electoral politics is a science. That's why they call it political science. So it doesn't impress me when people are saying how hard anybody is working to achieve a goal. That to me is just irritation. Thank you, Dave. We have Tony from New Jersey. Tony, you're on the air.
Hi, Latrice. I just wanted to sort of point this in a different direction, if I may, and get your outtake from it. Basically, I feel we're expelling needlessly energy on Republicans and Democrats and the government when we should be focusing on the true architect of it all. Now, here in New Jersey, one of my theories is I find it kind of strange. Every town that I go, I'm a truck driver, blue collar, I see different markings, like the Masons, the Rotary Club, and I used to drive over the road as well. And wherever I go, Connecticut or Michigan, I mean, you name it, they're everywhere. So there has to be some correlation, something connected with them, I believe, that, are they the true powers indeed? I mean, what's your take on that? I don't know.
You're seeing things everywhere, Tony. Everywhere you go, you're seeing things. Well, you know what? Actually, there have been books written, a lot has been written about the correlation between principally people like the Masons. You know, they've had that. You know, there's been a lot of work produced suggesting that Freemasonry had a very large role even as far back as the Civil War. In fact, there are those who even say that the Civil War was in effect among other things, the internal and domestic situation. It was also a war between the Scottish Rite Masons and the York Rite Masons. And they point to the fact that it is no accident that many of the presidents of the United States have been Masons and so forth. And yeah, that says a lot of stuff. I don't know what to make of it. I think it is interesting, though, to note. I was, in fact, on a tour in Washington, D.C. by the United African Movement. They had a tour of Washington, D.C. that was just mind-boggling to me. We actually went out in the field, and our tour guide was showing us. I mean, we actually went. This was not theoretical stuff being done in a class. And we saw the symbology in places you would never expect it, like the Library of Congress and many of the federal buildings, and the way that the architecture of Washington, D.C. is laid out, and where the Masons actually located their most powerful temples. And we actually went to the temples and saw all of the African symbology there. It was a fascinating thing. So these things are not unrelated, but I don't know, you know, that I could say that these are the people in control of any part of our process per se. It would take an expert, and I would have to defer to the experts on that. But I'm talking really about popular involvement insofar, because a lot of these things that you're talking about are things that are occurring behind closed doors. We don't know how they work, really. But what I'm talking about is what's allegedly in the open, what we're seeing. We're seeing these things, and we are supposedly a part of it. And my question to us is, to what degree do we acknowledge that there is, in the part that we can make work, there is a terrible flaw, and we have to look at it and fix it, if in fact we're interested in constructing an alternative?
Well, I mean, that's what I mean, I also did construction, and, you know, when there was a problem, you didn't go to the worker, the supervisor, or the foreman for that matter, okay? When the guys in the big suits came, they wanted to see the architect. And that's what I'm entailing is we're looking at the surface right now, okay, which is what we could perceive to be. But I think there's a deeper meaning. I mean, I feel like history as a hobby, and it's just too much to pass up with how you see the Egyptian, what type of symbols they use, and how they govern their people, okay, how they submissively put down rebellions also in Rome. And just like you mentioned with an architect, I mean, we're using borrowed, columns and other symbols from the Roman and the Egyptian. I mean, that's kind of, you know, too much to pass by, don't you think?
Well, it is the nature of the world where people, I mean, it is why the great philosophers all went to Africa to study philosophy and the sciences. And wherever you find knowledge, a center of knowledge, people would tend to gravitate toward that. And then it spreads. This is typical. This is how the world really works. So we find that there is a lot of exchange. What we find also is there's a lot of hidden attempts to hide these things. It's right there on every single Masonic temple. You see, you can't deny the origins of a lot of what it is they're thinking. But of course, it is not to be shared, that knowledge that they ascribe to a place, a source of higher learning, and they're required to learn certain things. I don't know what they are in the Masons. But this is the interesting thing about the world. People acquire knowledge and then apply it in sometimes nefarious ways, when in fact the whole point of knowledge is to create a better world. Some people use knowledge to create a better world solely and strictly for themselves. And they use knowledge as a way to contain the rights and hopes and dreams and aspirations of others. But thank you so much, Tony, for your call today. Well, I was able to just express my thoughts today, and I thank you for listening and sharing. And it's a theme that we'll continue talking about, because I think this is one of the awful truths that we have to face, that we have not been as creative as we ought to be. We have not been as successful as we ought to be in constructing alternatives, because we are still holding dear to us patterns that are themselves antithetical to progress. We got to stop it. And we could stop it by talking about it. So tune in tomorrow and let's continue the conversation. I want to thank you. You can always reach me at leadstories, LEID stories, @gmail.com. Thanks again. Bye-bye.